Test.
Yeah, they need to rebuild this whole damn complex, man.
I would like to thank you all for being here and your infinite patience. I'd like to thank our Sergeant-at-Arms, Mr. Bass, Mr. Moore, and Mr. Powell. Thank you for your endurance. Members of the committee, have you had a chance to review the minutes from our last stated meeting?
We did not have the meeting. Minutes, Mr. Chair.
They were sent out via email and they were placed on the website about a week and a half ago.
They were placed on the website and about a week and a half ago, and they were sent to your email addresses. We will have to have copies made for review of the committee.
I will yield to the will of the majority of the committee. That's fine.
In other words, if everybody else is okay, you're okay.
That being said, are there any questions, comments, or deletions from the minutes as stated? My assumption is the rest of the members have reviewed the minutes. You heard the motion on the floor. Is there any further discussion? If not, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion carried. Thank you. At this time, we will start with our presentations. And as you all learned just a short while ago, we're going to have a presentation via Skype. Ms. Seitz, bless her heart, has the honor of doing that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just so members know what's going on, I'm going to be operating the PowerPoint. Mr. Lindsley is going to be speaking via Skype, and I have kind of directions on when to change the slides. So hopefully I will be able to keep up with what's going on. If it's okay with the chair, I would ask that you hold any questions until he's finished his presentation, just so we don't have confusion about who's talking to whom. And then he's happy to answer questions at the end. So, Ted, if you can hear me, if you can unmute on your end.
Sure, I can.
Okay, and we're ready for you whenever you're ready to begin.
Okay. Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for this opportunity to brief you on the remarkable new developments taking shape in the UAS industry. As you know, I'm presenting today from Bangkok, Thailand, and I'm told this may be the first time to brief the committee by Skype. I think the IT guys have sorted out the firewall, so let's get started. My name is Ted Lindsley. I'm the founder and CEO of Olaris, developer of the first and only commercial drone system that's designed specifically for emergency management and first response. Before we proceed, I think it's important to clarify what's in a name. It's not surprising that some of the public is confused about UAS technology. And I think we use too many names to describe our technology, and that's often a distraction from what's important about unmanned aircraft systems. And it really doesn't matter if you drove here today in a sports car, a sedan, a pickup truck, a convertible, or a minivan. They're all automobiles. So let's skip the vocabulary and focus on the big picture. The economic opportunity for UAS in North Carolina is enormous. In fact, an attorney nicknamed the drone lawyer recently predicted on Bloomberg that drones will be bigger than the internet has been over the past 20 years. And he's right. He just won a ruling against the FAA proving that it's legal to operate low-level commercial drones across the U.S. Now, as you might imagine, that news has exploded across our industry, and big plans are forming as a result. Drones are coming faster than we think. Now, UAS technology will reinvent the aviation industry over the next 10 years, but that's only the beginning. The new electronics and sensors being built for these robotic aircraft will quickly be applied to almost every industry on the planet. Hundreds of new companies will be born from this technology, and many will launch new industries that haven't been invented yet. These companies will spin off from UAV manufacturers. North Carolina needs to establish a foothold in the UAS industry to get a competitive edge over all the other states. And that will create an incubator environment that's attractive to companies like Olaris. In turn, the robots, electronics, and components that we produce will begin to automate other industries, and growth will be dramatic. So the first state to actually integrate UAS operations will be seen as the most inviting destination for our industry to go. So why North Carolina? Well, the UAS industry right now has no home. Startups and their suppliers are beginning to open around the world, but they should be concentrated in one central location. Now, like Alaris, these companies are looking for some of the same key elements. We all need a governance plan like the one that's presented to this committee. We need open skies with the capability to fly statewide. We need an educated workforce that can fuel rapid growth and expansion. And we need an attitude that's focused on what we can do rather than what we can't do. Throughout 2013, we met with 19 different states looking for a headquarters we could call home. And it was the persistence of Kyle Snyder and NGAT that made us look closely at the Tar Heel State. What we discovered was absolutely amazing. North Carolina has an ideal climate and terrain for performing R&D, testing, proving of UAS technology. The greater Piedmont region sits at a perfect elevation of 1,200 feet, and this is nestled between mountainous peaks to the west and sea level to the east, all inside one state. So what this means to us is we can perform development, testing, certification, training, production, demonstrations, marketing, support, all inside one state. It's really just easier, and we don't have to go to different states to perform these different functions. Now, that's perfect for us. What's perfect for you is the fact that North Carolina needs UAS technology. The state is under constant threat of natural disasters like hurricanes, severe storms, flooding, freezing power lines, power outages, tornadoes, and so on. And the climate and terrain can also pose difficult challenges for emergency responders. They need to operate in a diversity of climates and terrains that often hinder the efforts like search and rescue. So this really is a perfect marriage of what our industry needs and what North Carolina has, but there's still much more. The Piedmont region has what I would call a twin sister. On the eastern edge of Europe, this is situated just between the Swiss Alps and Venice, is an area of northern Italy called Vicenza. And just like the Piedmont region of North Carolina, Vicenza was originally a textiles and agricultural zone. However, eventually times changed and that region moved on with new technology. Vicenza is now the mechatronics capital of Europe. And mechatronics is the combination of electrical engineering, mechanical engineering, software development, and systems architecture in order to create robotics and automated industrial systems. So this is how Alaris and other UAS companies develop robotic systems. Over the last 10 years, Vicenza has grown over 300 mechatronics companies, and these companies employ over 10,000 people with an output of more than $10.5 billion a year. The majority of these businesses are small to mid-sized entrepreneurial ventures. It's also interesting, the climate and the environment of Vicenza exactly matches that of central North Carolina. It has the same proximity to mountains and oceans, same temperatures, and like the Piedmont region, it's shifted away from textiles and into high-tech manufacturing. We think the central region of North Carolina is ideal to become the UAS and mechatronics capital of America. And to make that happen, we have to move quickly and we have to execute our plans with precision before other states steal our thunder and announce similar sounding plans ahead of North Carolina. What hangs in the balance is hundreds of new companies with thousands of jobs and an opportunity to be first in flight again. Here's how we'll do it. Now, Alaris has developed the first and only commercial UAS that's designed specifically for first response and emergency management. We spent 2 years going through design reviews with police, fire, and disaster management commanders to develop AVA. This is a solution that can serve all agencies simultaneously. Now, this provides a statewide system architecture that joins all your city, county, and state agencies together under one umbrella so they can loan, borrow, and share UAS assets as they're needed. It also helps them cooperate and coordinate emergency response efforts. In addition, it's an open architecture system. Now, that means you're not trapped into a single vendor with a proprietary technology that holds you hostage. You can add, change, replace, and update the assets in the years ahead, making it flexible and economical. But most important, the system is distributed locally for fast response to local emergencies, but it can be directed centrally from one state-level command location in a major disaster. Now, AVA was also designed to support routine government needs as well. Unlike the aircraft that your emergency management teams are already operating, AVA is a tool you'll use every day. And this makes infrastructure inspections on bridges and water towers easy. Inspection of icing power lines, electrical outages, this all becomes safe and simple. Coastal patrol to protect swimmers along the beaches is economical, it's practical. Monitoring and prevention of industrial pollution, like the recent coal ash incident, is easy. Even Parks Department surveys and dozens of other government applications can all be served by this system. And you can do it from one central office without the need to send personnel into the field. So last month, a group called Market Info Group published a new study called A First Responder's Buying Guide, an Operating Concept for UAS. And this is one of the most respected independent analyst publications in our industry. In that report, MIG concluded that OLARIS meets all of their guidelines for successfully integrating a domestic emergency response UAS. In fact, OLARIS is the only company in the world that met 100% of their recommendations and requirements. Now, this is important because it provides an outside independent analysis of the strategy that NGAT is recommending, and it endorses the government plan that's been drafted. Now, inevitably, the issue of privacy fears, surveillance, improper use of drones comes up in these discussions. The media has done a great job sensationalizing drones, but they've failed educating the public about the realities of this technology. What it can do and what it can't do are significantly misunderstood. We intend to change that through transparency and education. But the bottom line is, we plan to live in North Carolina too. And I really don't want a predator drone staring at my backyard any more than you do. But when my house is being burglarized or I'm injured in a serious traffic accident, I want help measured in seconds, not minutes. Now, some nonprofit agencies have taken advantage of this public fear and they've used it as a political chip to further their own causes. And this is partly because the public hasn't been exposed to routine domestic UAS operations yet. So the unknown is sometimes scary. In reality, what's scary is the UAS companies are choosing to go to China, India, Australia, and other countries where there's less fear about the technology and more interest in building an industry with it. Now, if that doesn't stop, the majority of US customers will end up buying their unmanned aircraft systems from overseas, and America will lose another industry that we invented. So OLARIS is here today to provide a path forward for domestic drones. We can help North Carolina set an example of how they can be used responsibly for the benefit of the people being served while operating under the scrutiny of those same people. In the last few months, public opinion about drones has shifted significantly. And this is partly due to new exposure and education about UAS technology. For example, the recent 60 Minutes report on Amazon was perhaps the first time a major corporation has explained positive benefits of UAS technology to a national television audience. And what's important about that program is the public sentiment and statistics that followed the broadcast. As of this past weekend, more than 14 million people had viewed that story on YouTube. And of those, 53,000 bothered to click like. whereas only 4,700 felt it important enough to click dislike. And this clearly shows that as the public learns more about the practical uses for UAS technology, the overwhelming silent majority approve of it, whereas the vocal minority begin to fade away quietly into the background. Now, last December, Alaris issued a press release indicating we were interested in making our home in North Carolina. Aside from the global attention that received, we were really impressed by the warm welcome we got from residents of North Carolina. In the first 10 days following that release, we received dozens of employment inquiries from engineers. We heard from UAS pilots, trainers, and even local veterans. Now, some of these had valuable UAS experience, and they're going to be exiting North Carolina military bases pretty soon. More than 30 supply chain merchants contacted us in the first week about vendor opportunities. And as a result of that news, we actually plan to leverage these local vendors, and those companies will grow with us and the other mechatronics and robotics companies in the future. PBS also contacted us about producing a segment on Alaris moving to North Carolina and about the state plans for unmanned aircraft systems. Now, they feel this is a historic moment in aviation, and they want to broadcast that program to 60 million homes nationwide in the fall. The emphasis of that program is going to be how progressive North Carolina is, how large the UAS industry is, and the new university opportunities that we're going to be creating. We also, it's kind of funny, but we also received regret emails from three of the other 18 states that we were talking to, but we can talk about that at another time. So this is not the first time we visited North Carolina. Alaris spent the first 8 months of 2013 working with the city of Greensboro to become the first municipality in the nation to integrate a citywide UAS. Now, the city leadership was enthusiastic, and they recognized the value proposition quickly. Their emergency response commanders all acknowledged that AVA would help them perform more effectively, would enhance their efficiency, and would improve safety. We came there for a week, met everybody, and they were excited. Unfortunately, that plan was stalled last October because state-level UAS guidelines had not been written yet. And despite enthusiasm, Greensboro just felt hesitant about proceeding with the plan without support from the state level. Now, that was a disappointing defeat for North Carolina as a whole, and it delayed our plans to move to North Carolina, too. Had we proceeded, Alaris would already be in North Carolina hiring personnel and ramping up production. Now, states like California, Washington, and Ohio are making their own UAS plans, and they hope to beat North Carolina out of the UAV race. We had a comfortable one-year lead over the other states. The question now is, can North Carolina proceed diligently and maintain the lead time that we have left? So our plan is to integrate the foundation architecture for a statewide UAS that can be grown gradually over the years ahead. And the governance plan is a first step to establish the framework. Then operating guidelines can be adopted and amended as needed. And this will restore some of North Carolina's lead in the race towards building a local UAS industry. It'll also instill confidence in city and county leaders like those in Greensboro who are waiting for a nod from the state level before exploring their own UAS integration plans. The initial overlay provides statewide UAS capability for disaster management. And this gives an even disbursement of aircraft that can all be controlled from one central location. It also provides support to rural police and fire departments, which often suffer from a long response time because of their remote location and the distance to an emergency. As the cities and counties across North Carolina begin integrating their own UAS assets, they become part of the overall network governed at the state level. And this ensures compliance with transparent operating guidelines and policies, so everything is accountable to the elected leaders. In the case of our AVA system, it automatically publishes the details of every flight. And this level of transparency keeps concerned citizens informed of exactly when, where, why, and how the UAS is being used. So there's no secrecy involved. total disclosure is an absolute must. Now, in the event of a natural disaster like a hurricane, statewide UAS assets can be quickly relocated to coastal areas, and they can begin search and rescue efforts even before field personnel arrive, all controlled from a central location like Riley. And once the work is finished, they simply return home to their primary service areas. So, how do we get there? Well, much of the heavy lifting is already done. Of the 19 states we met, NGAC has the clearest understanding of UAS technology and the clearest strategy for implementing it properly. And that's probably because the director, Kyle Snyder, comes from the UAS industry's trade organization called AUVSI, and he has years of experience working with it. With swift approvals and execution, it's not too late to restore the lead that North Carolina had in 2013. We can begin attracting a $300 billion industry. I estimate that at least one U.S. state will announce a strategy before the end of this coming summer. We just hope that North Carolina can beat them to it. Well, that concludes my overview. I hope this has been informative. And if you have any questions, I invite you to open them now.
If they ask questions, if you'll let me repeat them so he can clearly hear them. Then.
Members of the committee, as questions come forward, Susan will have to repeat them to the presenter so he can hear them clearly. Any questions from the committee? Representative Sain.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The question is, total disclosure was mentioned on the flight paths. Is that before or after the flights have flown?
Ted, the question is, in the issue of total disclosure, is that disclosure before or after the flight has flown?
Well, it's up to the state and up to the agencies. We can do it either way. The system's built with flexibility. In a perfect situation, the way we designed it, it would actually be disclosed just afterwards to protect the safety of field responders. So in most cases, you'd probably want to disclose those after the flight, but that's entirely up to how you want to design your policies.
Further questions to the committee? Representative Tolson.
Can he give us two or three steps that we need to take to regain that lead?
Ted, the question is, can you give two or three specific steps that we need to take to regain the lead?
Yeah, we really, and it's in the presentation, the governance plan is the first step. That lets you move forward quickly. If NGAD has the governance plan approved and a sufficient budget to hire some people and move ahead, they can make this happen. It's just like a domino effect. So one or two, well, good example, Alaris is already interested in coming there, and our key supplier has already contacted us and said, when you pick a home city, let us know because we want to open up an office right next to you. This is a supplier that's based out of Australia, but they already recognize the impact that our technology is going to have, and so they want to put an office directly next to us because they realize that potentially dozens and dozens of other companies will open up right around us, and so they want to have that close proximity, just in the same way that Silicon Valley was grown in the 50s and 60s.
Representative Whitmire.
Ted mentioned, had a graphic on the different geographical features of the state, compared it to Vicenza, Italy, and also climate, which basically related to the various emergency response type items, either mycin, hurricanes, tornadoes, and what have you. Seems as though it would be focused more in the central part of the state. If testing in the mountains at 6,700 feet or 6,684 is your highest point, would any of the economic benefits that go with having infrastructure there to do some of your testing be outside of primarily a centralized Piedmont location?
Ted, I'm going to kind of summarize, and Representative Whitmire will let me know if I don't get the. But you mentioned the geographic situations of North Carolina, but it sounds like you're indicating that most of the base for this would be in the Piedmont region. In doing testing in areas like the mountains, would there also be facilities and resources located there for economic impact, or would it all be in the middle of the state?
Well, I think you'll see it all over. We're interested in having one primary location, but we'll have support people spread in different areas. Ultimately, you'll see companies congregate in one area, but they're going to want to work all over the state. In the grand scheme of things, this is a solution that's going to bolster everything. In 10 years, you will not see an agency that doesn't operate these kind of systems. It'll just become a standard as with buying a police truck, a police car, or a fire engine. It's just more practical. It kind of reminds me of the old days when, 100 years ago, policemen walked a patrol beat, and the solution was hire more policemen and put them on foot patrol. It was probably a very innovative concept to put in a police car and have them drive around. We take that for granted today, but in the beginning, that was pretty innovative. And so the same thing will happen here. We're talking about a statewide impact all the way across the board. And you're talking about components and companies that will spin off from this technology that will be spread all over the place. And it's not just those companies. It's the supply chain as well. We were surprised at the capabilities that North Carolina has, fiberglass, carbon fiber, sub-electronic components, assembly, and they're spread all over the state. So this reaches really every corner of the state.
Representative Faircloth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Triad has developed a very viable aviation industry, and I wonder if there's any interaction or cooperation between the aviation industry as we know it and the unmanned aircraft industry.
Ted, the question is that the Triad, which you refer to as the Piedmont region, has already developed a viable aircraft industry. Has there been any cooperation and work with that existing aircraft industry and the AVS?
Very little, because it's a different model. Conventional aircraft manufacturing is labor intensive for manufacturing. And UAS are flipped in a reverse model, where the biggest concentration of early work is engineers and scientists constantly innovating and developing not just the system but new technology. But what will happen is a shift. The industry is expected to explode to $300 billion because it's expected to begin replacing a lot of the conventional aircraft business. So this is equally a strategic move for North Carolina that's already reliant on the aircraft industry to shift with it, with changing things, so that you're not only committed to an old style of aviation, but you're embracing the new technology that will gradually begin replacing it.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With regard to the aviation industry, is there any negative relationship between the two? We've heard in previous meetings, I think, about some concerns about interaction between aircraft as they're flying. Does that pose any problem in the central area of the state?
Ted, as a follow-up, in looking at aircraft, is there any negative interaction with the aircraft industry? We have heard in a previous meeting that there were some concerns about unmanned aircraft being in the airspace and possibly colliding with manned aircraft and that sort of thing. Has there been any indication of that in the Piedmont area or in the discussions?
No, we've heard nothing. It's a valid concern that has to be addressed, but we feel like we solved that problem years ago. It's just that the industry is trying to learn it. They're trying to figure out how to integrate UAS into the manned commercial airspace, which is actually incorrect. What we're talking about is flying UAS below the vast majority of that. Really, our operational altitude is about 300 or 400 feet, and I won't go into all the technical details there, but that's important because that's away from manned traffic. Nonetheless, it is our responsibility to make sure it's safe. And so we put all the safeguards in place to make sure the system is actually smarter than the pilot. And so the result is our system actually has more capabilities than those conventional aircraft. It's got all the same avionics that American Airlines would have on board their system, but it also has collision avoidance systems that take over autonomous control so that you can avoid a mishap. And that's just necessary for a practical introduction of the technology. You know, there's a lot of that on our website you can look at.
Further questions from the committee? Representative Folger, excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It sounds like there's a public-private contemplation of ownership of these assets. In one case, the private ownership would have their uses for pipeline exploration, and et cetera. Then the public would be lots of emergency management. Who owns the assets that are used for public use, and what do you contemplate the budget would be for public use? Second part of the question, all the public and private uses, I assume, would be under the same governance rules. Is that correct?
Ted, is kind of a two-part question. First, in context, it sounds like there's two possible uses, a public usage and private usage. For the public usage, who would actually own the assets? And then in relation to the private usage, is the governance of both projected to be under the same governance?
Well, for what we're talking about, go ahead.
I'm sorry, and the question I forgot is, for the public usage, what's a ballpark anticipated budget for purchasing the assets and maintaining the assets and operating them?
Well, that's a loaded question, because actually the design of this system is not operating one single aircraft. The beauty of it is it operates as a fleet working together. But you don't need to have Greensboro, Winston-Salem, Riley, they don't need to all operate their own independent systems on their own governance. That's the beauty of the governance plan that's being introduced by NGAT, is that everything falls under the control of one organization, so that as things are added by these different cities, and they could either own them outright or they could lease them, there's lots of different ways you could do this, but really they should control it. It doesn't make sense to me to have an outside vendor operating the aircraft for you, because there's a delay in the response time, there's a delay in the information exchange. And I spent 4 years working for a police department when I was going to school, and I've worked at a dispatch center for a long time. I see what works and what doesn't, and that's come into play with this as well. And so it's really ideal to have these owned and operated, or at least controlled by the state level. And when you get into private systems, that's a different game altogether. And you're going to see that happening over the next couple of years pretty quickly. It becomes impractical to fly helicopters for traffic and for news gathering when you can use a system like this to do the same job for less than 10 cents on the dollar to buy it and pennies on the dollar to operate it. Pipeline inspections, power line monitoring and inspections, and on and on and on. These are all industries we intend to go into. But to do that first and responsibly and earn the trust of the public, we felt like the emergency management was really the best place to start.
Further questions or comments from the committee? Representative Tolson.
Just a comment. We are sitting on the edge here of another explosion of an industry, just like we had with biotech. Now, we were a leader in putting money into the biotech industry early on. North Carolina became a leader. We can, and as Peter just indicated, we can become a leader here, but we need to make sure this government plan and some money is put forward to make this thing happen. And I hope this committee, that's one of your big recommendations that we have.
And I would like to say that I think the concern raised in the PowerPoint regarding those that want regulation are, in my opinion, very much justified, because we need to get on the edge of the regulation and get ahead of this game for once, if we can at all. Any further questions from the committee?
Ted, thank you very much. I'm going to disconnect now, and I think Kyle will probably fill you in on the rest of the meeting.
Very good. Thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you. I would like to say that's the first time I have ever been involved with Skype at a legislative committee meeting. From Thailand at that. At this time, we will have our next presenter, Mr. Young Kim.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Moffitt.
A couple of questions for the chair of committee. Ted had mentioned the study for the buyer's guide that was made available for the first responders. And I know it is a privately produced document. Is there any way members of the committee could access that somewhere, review what's contained in that buyer's guide?
It's available on public market. You can purchase that.
Well, I know that.
I haven't bought one yet.
Okay, fair enough. And secondly, when it comes to the purview of this committee, the FAA is going to pretty much decide the use of these drones around airports. Is that correct?
I believe, if I can just stand up to make sure we get recorded. It's my understanding that the FAA will regulate anything that's in the area where the airplanes are flying, and that we're still under the restriction on the commercial flights to an extent.
So, but as I've previously stated, it's my understanding that the FAA is only planning to regulate for safety purposes and not usage purposes. So, just as an example, throwing things, they might say you can't fly within 500 yards of an airport, but they're not going to say you can't, Amazon can't use it to deliver necessarily. So,
follow up.
Do you have any idea how far they are in their process of their rulemaking?
I believe they were supposed to have issued a report recently, and that date has been extended, but I don't recall to when. Kyle, do you know?
Chris will talk about it right now. I'm still holding to the November date, but given the announcement 2 weeks ago, they're probably going to
tell you. Right. Any further comments or questions from the committee at this point? At this time, we will hear from our second presenter, Mr. Young Kim.
Yeah,
if you just left-click
whenever you want to change a slide.
Can I go back?
I think if you right-click.
Right-click.
Previous.
Yeah. And then
left-click
to go forward.
Yeah.
Okay. Very good.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to share some of my thoughts here. I will, as you can tell, English is not my primary language, so I will not be as glib nor articulate as Ted, so I'll use that as a crutch if I get into trouble throughout the presentation. I am the general manager of a company called Bosch Precision Agriculture. Our sister company, Bosch Global Services, currently provides unmanned aircraft services for the Defense Department and our NATO allies. Most of our understanding of, let me take that back, all of our understanding of how to operate safely and the value of UAS comes from our sister organization. There's one key difference, and this is as it should be. The Bosch Global Services, when we serve our military, is done with the figure of merit of outcome. For example, we need to provide the services of 99% outcome, number of missions flown, and etc. Whereas Bosch Precision Agriculture is a commercial-centric company. The figure of merit is economics. When you look at our customers, they're the growers. Their figure of merit is economics, how to increase yield and lower the cost. And so although we share technical synergy, the mindset from a business is 180 degrees out. One's outcome-driven, as it should be, and we are commercial-driven, as we should be. So everything that I talk about will have that in mind. And based on the questions from the representatives here, let me quickly go through my 10 slides and try to reserve as much time as possible for Q&A. So here's a quote. It says, feature is already here, it's just not evenly distributed. As per the previous speaker, there's an opportunity for North Carolina to take advantage of that notion that when it's currently not evenly distributed and it's focused in North Carolina amongst a sprinkle of some other states, what do you do with that? I'll come back to that towards the end of the presentation. Those three photographs, the first big one, your center one, is one of our smaller UAVs called the Super Swiper, and it was approved through working with Kyle. And that flight in that airport you see there on your left-hand side of the screen is Hyde County. It was taking place about a year ago, and within the last 2 or 3 weeks, the RMAX crop spraying robotic helicopter recently got submitted for a certificate of authority, as well as the aircraft on the lower right. That aircraft will fly for about 8+ hours, whereas the smaller one with the airport flies about 1.5 hours. All three of those, we hope to have it fly in around June of this year. And then we have some more aircraft coming online. By the way, North Carolina is where we have the most amount of UAS activity amongst all the other states. So this is probably old hat, but just to provide a quick reference, aerial imagery does these things much, much more, but here's some very quick snapshots from an agriculture perspective. Again, this enables the grower or the crop consultants to do their jobs better, bottom line, economics, to be able to help scout. As you can see, some discoloration. you now know that there's an anomaly. So rather than walking the field on the periphery, if you have soybeans or corn, it's tough to walk in the middle of the field. This allows you to give you a position where you've got an anomaly. It doesn't tell you what is causing it. It certainly gives you an anomaly. And that is the early stage of where we are technologically. When we go forward, we're not only going to be able to tell you something is wrong, we're going to be able to tell you what is wrong, and then thereafter what you can do to prevent it or address it. And then one step after that, it is to be able to predict. And by that I mean, for example, if you, I know sugar cane is not grown in North Carolina, but figure of merit for sugar cane is, for example, 12% sugar. You take that, and that's what Mother Nature gives you, and you just gather, harvest as much as you can. We're going to have technology very soon where rather than taking what Mother Nature gives you, we will have the smarts to go, we now want 14% sugar. What do we need to do to that plant to get 14% sugar in terms of nutrients, soil, when to plant, what kind of varieties, and so forth and so on. That technology is coming, and it's primarily because of digital technology, which I'll highlight just a little bit in a couple of slides. Okay, so this gives you the value of aerial imagery that the most of the growers in the United States in particular have not had access to. So, for example, you can have what this shows is compaction. Compaction basically determines how hard the soil is. Is it made out of mud? Is it made out of sand? What's the composition? If it has too much mud, the nutrients can't get into the roots. If it has too much sand, the nutrients leach. Knowing this data allows you to manage your field quite differently. If you thought it was a uniform body, now you have this variable picture. You now are able to think variably, right? So there's this variable rate technology that is coming very, very strongly in agriculture. And if you don't address compaction, you'll get conditions like the lower left or the lower right. Your corn do not grow as tall. So now you've got this data, you can do things differently. Oops. Okay, so last photo. Again, you can detect these type of anomalies. So this technology has been around quite a while. Manned aircraft have provided this kind of imagery. So what is the big deal with UAS? For the very first time in agriculture, you have a tool where you're able to get these type of images more frequently and less cost with higher resolution. Never in agriculture has those three components come together. More frequent, higher resolution, and less cost. When those three things combine in other massive industries like telecommunications, medicine, transportation, logistics, things start to happen that you haven't predicted. It's not a linear growth. Things happen in ways that are quite nonlinear. And this is what agriculture is going through today. So that's what unmanned systems allows you to do that hasn't been done before. Okay, so step back. Why am I so passionate about agriculture? I have a nuclear physics degree from Georgia Tech, and I never thought I would be walking the apple orchards nor cornfields. And I did that a few weeks ago down in South America, and I looked at why am I here in an apple orchard down in Chile looking at apples? It is because of this diagram. So imagine yourself as a commercial real estate developer, and that big rectangular box is your piece of real estate. When you develop real estate, do you then go after Subways initially, or do you go after the Kroger's, Publix, or Food Lion, or et cetera, equivalent? You go after the anchor tenant first. And if you do the anchor tenant, all the others follow. To me, agriculture represents this in UAS. Why? Because in Georgia, there's a $68 billion economic impact. In North Carolina, the numbers I read, an economic impact is close to $80 billion. No other industry comes close. If you can figure out how to deliver this kind of capability to agriculture, you're going to be able to do it with economic value in mind. And all the green boxes, including agriculture, as well as to the right, wide area assessment is like when you're clearing bombing ranges. Pipeline is pretty obvious, some others. All the green ones are economically driven industries, very, very large. The wide area assessment on the top right corner, just in the United States, there are 50 million acres where they pay $100 to $175 per acre to clear, to survey, not clear, with a manned aircraft. So So again, let's make the math easy. If it's $100 per acre and there's 50 million acres, that's $5 billion. Just that opportunity alone. And I consider that as a niche market. The flight profile in using an unmanned vehicle to detect the ferrous material, iron material, is exactly the same flight profile that we would fly when we fly our robotic helicopter for crop spraying. 10 to 20 feet off the deck, autonomous flight with a magnetometer. Except in this case, we'd probably go down to about 2 meters. But it's the same basic technical capability that if you can do crop spraying, you can take that business and that capability in the offices and potentially address the wide area assessment business. Same thing with pipeline. So this is what I mean by agriculture being the anchor tenant application. If you focus on agriculture, it enables all the other things. Even if the applications are the ones like Ted talked about on the left, these are what I call event-driven. You have assets, capital-intensive, you have people trained, you have to wait until something happens. And this is where outcome-driven business model makes sense. You need these type of capabilities when these outcomes occur. But if you have a main bread-and-butter business that's commercial-centric, you now have additional margins to service those event-driven business models. Again, this is the rationale that I use as an entrepreneur, is looking at agriculture as the anchor application. If you can do it, you can do many, many other things that we all talk about and get excited about UAS. So this is an anathema or contrary to what we call the vicious cycle. I call this the virtuous cycle, and it is happening now. Companies on the left, and I haven't updated this slide for probably about a year, but the point here is, and you can certainly put Olaris up there, lots and lots of new technology-centric companies popping up all over the globe, in the United States, in North Carolina, everywhere, because they see the opportunity. And then on the right-hand side, you see the acquirers. Monsanto acquired Climate Corporation that was started in 2006 for $920 or $930 million. That's about $120-some-odd million in valuation per year from the founding. And they did it primarily to predict micro weather over farms. And then you've got conferences that are traditional ag-centric conferences now adding specifically UAS tracks. In the middle, you've got mainstream media. You know, this used to be sort of a specialty from organizations like, or Kyle and I served, AUVSI. But now Wall Street picks it up, Forbes picks it up. It comes on 60 Minutes. And then on top there in the middle are the investors who are willing to take big risk for big rewards. These are very, very smart, very successful folks who have a track record of building the likes of Yahoo, Google, and all the names you've heard about. Those people are now getting into UAS and with an application for agriculture. That's a pretty good flag for you to focus on, saying the market is here. What are you going to do? So that's what I call a virtuous cycle. It feeds on itself, and it's getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Agriculture, I didn't know, was more than, or it turned out, is much more than for food. And this is just one crop, soybean. It is used for automotive. Did you know that? It's used in engine oils. It's a replacement for petroleum. I didn't know it was in soap. I didn't know you could have soy-based plastics. Home materials. So if you think about that, agriculture now starts to touch industry that, for me anyway, I didn't see the dots. Now they're connected, so the market becomes even bigger. And this is, I just pick one crop, that's soybeans, that you grow a lot here. So I break this down into the 1.0 and the 2.0. Okay, so then now you've got UAVs flying. The upper left is what we call the Protector 10, And the one below it is that robotic crop spraying helicopter that we will both fly in Hyde County, hopefully around June, depending on when FAA makes their decision. And here's what I think is coming. This is the near future. When you've got UAV technologies, combine it with agriculture, and then this convergence, what I broadly call information technologies. That is things like the cloud, communications, wireless, connectivity, bandwidth that gets greater and gets cheaper. One more. Let me give you some examples of what this means. And that may be too small for many of you folks to read, so I'll do that. External hard drive, back in 2007, 1 terabyte at Costco was $370. I just checked this weekend. Costco now sells a 4 terabyte hard drive for about $150. Okay, let me go to the next one. Individual genome sequenced. Back in 2007, it was $1 million. We're now at about $1,000 to $4,000, depending on the vendor. And within the next couple years, it'll be $100. What does that have to do with agriculture? I point to the newsprint right above the aircraft on your right side. A single character, the cost of printing a single character in the newspaper in 2010 was equivalent cost what it cost to print a transistor. IT technology, folks, is going to impact agriculture like you've never seen before. It is happening today. This is what I mean by 2.0. It's not just about UAV. It is what you do with that data and how that data gets distributed, processed, and turned into actionable intelligence. Agriculture, to me, is one of those rare global industries, probably top 2 or 3 in the world, that have not been impacted with technology to a degree like other major industries, and it's going to catch up very quickly. So what does that mean? To a North Carolina farmer, you see a happy face on your right. If he's happy, many, many, many other stakeholders are happy. Vendors are happy, investors are happy, economic development folks are happy. So the key focus for us is how do we make that farmer smile by delivering him or her economic value. Last slide. This appeared in 1925. Henry Ford put a full-page ad in the Saturday Evening Post. This is when Henry Ford was quite successful, was known throughout the world. He got invited by all the countries they've been doing business to come and expand. He put this out. Opening the highways to all mankind. What he wanted to do was democratize cars. It was only available to the wealthy. I was asked by Susan and by Kyle to convey some thoughts for this committee. And it's a bit contrarian to what you've probably heard thus far. It is not the UAS industry you want to attract. In fact, personally, I don't think you want to attract or do a lot of effort to attract industries in North Carolina. That doesn't solve the problem. The problem is a market problem. It's not a tax incentive. It's not buildings. It's none of that. Because all the other states who are interested in this space offer that. So you offer nothing differentiated. What I do believe will motivate me, because we are looking at relocating on the campus of NCSU, is if North Carolina had the most progressive, technically aggressive, or technically early adopter growers. If you can help educate the growers in North Carolina to do and accept or open to these new techniques, it's not just UAS. So all the other technologies coming online. If North Carolina can be known as a state where its growers are the most technically progressive, open-minded, and there's assistance in one form or another by the state government to help subsidize or educate such that they have the reputation that they are willing to try new techniques as long as it gives them an economic advantage, then people like me who are economically motivated will find a way to come here and do business. So I would ask you to at least consider, help us, help North Carolina solve the market problem. With that, thank you.
Representative Torbett.
Question. Thank you for your presentation. You mentioned the two birds that you're working with FAA. Are you trying to get experimental with FAA? What are you?
No, it's certificate authority, COAs. All of our aircraft are focused on COAs. And in the meantime, as an aside, I did not want to build a business depending on the whims of the FAA. Not smart. They've got a really important and a tough job. They're in a hard spot. But to build a company based on their timing, I thought was not a smart move. So we are flying manned aircraft with the sensors that we actually fly on our UAVs in North Carolina and in Georgia, Florida, and in Virginia.
Further questions from the committee? For Mr. Kim. Representative Moffitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to say that English as your second language is better than mine is my first language. On these, just a question about these unmanned vehicles. Are they always piloted, or sometimes are they programmable to where they can fly on their own?
So UAS, to my definition, actually stands for Unmanned Autonomous Systems. And what you want is you want to take advantage of the sophistication of electronics for these vehicles to be flown autonomously, and you allow the human operator to be the safety monitor. To me, that's the architecture of leveraging the best of both worlds, where the human operator can interrupt at any time when they have a concern, but most of its operational mission time is done by an autopilot. Takeoff, mission, recovery, emergency situations, and let that human in the loop take over, just like manned aircraft operation.
Follow up.
As quickly as this technology is evolving, do you anticipate that at some point in the future that human element will not be part of that equation?
No, sir, I don't, because I think we'll always need that. As much of a technology as I am, technology always has limits. And you want that human operating in the loop.
Representative Tolson.
In your description of education, educating the farmer, educating the agricultural personnel, do you see a need for some education on ethics related to the operators of these units?
I believe that needs to be a concern from every provider. And that should not be assumed that the operator will behave ethically. At the same time, for us, we exercise capitalism with a conscience. Without conscience, capitalism doesn't work. At the same time, you can't leave that to chance. So we believe that is something that we must address explicitly. Yes, sir.
Representative Whitmire.
This is more of a comment, but there's a question in here somewhere, and I'll get to it when I find it. When it comes to, just someone on the street may hear the various terms for unmanned aircraft. In reality, that's a remotely piloted vehicle. You touched on it. If they're in a remote location or line of sight, whatever it is, there's a person. And this goes with Assembly Representative Moffitt's question about, is there any intention to take the person out of that loop? Until that happens, if it does happen, from the standpoint of having human intervention that's guiding that aircraft of whatever nature, they simply are not on the aircraft, they're on the ground at the terminal. I think that context is important for people who want to maybe go to several degrees beyond the coulda, shoulda, what might happen if this comes to this. In the end, we've got a human in the loop. I think that's important to emphasize in this regard. You mentioned that your systems are not dependent on the FAA for approval from the standpoint of building a business model or having a business. You mentioned a couple of profiles of flight, if it was doing pipelines, you're doing other type things. In the mode of operation where you're doing it with manned aircraft, you're probably not flying them in the same profile. In other words, You mentioned
right.
potentially 2 meters off the ground if it's a UAS. If you've got a person on there for safety reasons, they're up higher. What's, just for a minute, for however long you need to, talk to the cost differential and a lot of the other things that come with having a manned flight versus an unmanned flight in terms of the efficiencies you have if you're with unmanned.
Right, so let's take two. One is, again, outcome-driven, one's economics. So today, when you're doing, when you're clearing mines for things like bombing ranges and minefields and so forth, and you have to do it over a very large area, they actually do use a manned helicopter flying at 2 meters off the deck. And if you envision that with the addition of a long plastic PVC pipe, you will, about 20 feet in front of the nose, and you have a magnet. You want that because you want to isolate the magnet from all the electromagnetic noise coming from the aircraft. That's on your nose, which doesn't give you a whole lot of pitch authority. It's on your left and right, which doesn't give you a whole lot of roll. And you have to fly this, hand fly it, 2 meters off the deck because you want that magnet as close to the ground as possible. Because you have a human in the loop, for safety reasons, the pilot's going to fly fast. Faster than he normally should from a technical standpoint, because when he has something wrong, he'd like to be able to climb and have an opportunity to recover. So you've got that kinetic energy that you can then take advantage of. On an unmanned aircraft, it would be very different. It would fly much slower because you don't have the human factor involved. So you would fly that sensor the way it's supposed to be flown at about 10 to 15 miles an hour. So that's one case. And then certainly the economics will be much, much less expensive, right? Because it just seems ludicrous to me. Ludicrous perhaps is too extreme. You're carrying a sensor about 2 pounds on an aircraft that weighs 4,000 pounds. That doesn't make a lot of sense to me from a first-order engineering principle, right? If you're carrying 2 pounds, you would want to carry on an aircraft that may perhaps weigh 100 pounds or something like that. And so the economics certainly is much less. Let's look at pipeline, for example. I think it'll be a long time before pipeline really becomes mainstream application for UAS. Because if you talk to BP, Shell, and those guys, their figure meter is $1 per mile. And so they literally have a retired guy inside the cockpit with binoculars looking out. And they have to do this 26 times a year because it's mandated by the authorities. And all they have to prove is that, yes, they've inspected visually. So the figure of merit there is $3 per mile using a manned aircraft with a retired guy with binoculars. That's good enough from an oil company's perspective. UAVs today, for you to do pipeline inspection, you have to have very long endurance. So you have to have transmitters. You have to have ground control stations because it also has to fly fairly low. When you do that, you've got the curvature of the earth issues. So you have to have infrastructure. And so for a while, it will not be $3 a mile. So it's nice to talk about, but when we get to a technology where you can beat $3 a mile, you'll not only be able to look with your eyeballs, but you'll be able to actually sense and sniff carbon leaks using hydrocarbon sensors and be able to detect leaks rather than just visual inspection. So the efficacy will go up, but I think it's going to be well we have a UAV system and the appropriate infrastructure that allows that to be possible.
Brief follow-up. The early presentation was more of an emergency response. There's plenty of cases to where, due to weather, due to terrain, due to elements, you certainly could be much safer. Normally, the human is the superior choice to have in an aircraft. I'm a pilot, 4,000 hours.
It's me too, and I disagree.
But there are situations, such as a search and rescue mission, where the weather is below minimums, you can't launch the mission. But if you can do it with an unmanned aircraft, you can do the mission and you can
stay alive. Absolutely. So you're on station time. The ability to do on station, carry out the mission, absolutely gets much better with an unmanned system because you don't have to have that risk. Agreed. I flew AWACS aircraft, and our limitation was the crew. The aircraft would do just fine, but in Desert Storm, we flew for 24 hours, and we came down because of other limitations besides the aircraft.
And now you have Global Hawk up there for 36 plus.
Right.
Representative Ford?
Yes. Can your UAV gather geodetical information?
Geodetical.
Borders, like we're having a border dispute with South Carolina. There are counties in the state. We're doing a lot of geodetical surveys.
Yes, sir.
And right now it's very labor intensive.
So,
I just wonder if the UAV could do that too.
Yes, sir. I think that's a basic functionality for all UAV photogrammetry missions, because not because we have any a special sauce, but because the COTS, the commercial off-the-shelf components, actually has a GPS on them. All autopilots have a GPS, otherwise you wouldn't have you can't have an autopilot. So that GPS stamps each imagery, and you can correlate that with additional reference points. But yes, sir, with that GPS, you can correlate exact location. And so the way we do it, we will literally overlay those images and put it on Google Earth, and the grower can log on to Google Earth and see their farm that way. Sure.
Any additional questions? Thank you. We appreciate your time and your trouble. At this time, we will hear from Mr. Chris Estes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the. I'm Chris Estes. I'm a State Chief Information Officer. I'm going to share with you some background on a report that we produced out of the State Chief Information Officer's office. Regarding unmanned air systems, we'll start with, as some of the other presenters talked about, we'll start back in 1903 with the first manned flight, and then we'll move forward over the next several hours. Just kidding, we're not going to go that far back.
Your actual report is on the website if you just want to remind them that it's there.
Yes, the report is on the website for those that are following along, that was produced by the office. The highlights of the report are really these six sections, and I'm going to go through each of those as a slide in the PowerPoint and then answer questions. Just to level set, there were some questions about who governs the UAS flights. It's an interesting question, good question. FAA right now is the highest governing authority. There's some question about that recently. In the second bullet, you'll see that there was some litigation that occurred on a student in Virginia who was flying an unmanned air system. FAA fined him $10,000, I believe. He filed a lawsuit, countersuit. The judge ruled in his favor and said the FAA didn't have the authority to limit his flight. The FAA has since disagreed, and there's some debate about that right now. So this is an open discussion with the FAA, but we'll let them resolve that. Here in North Carolina, specifically, North Carolina has limited the flight of any government entity that needs to have the authority of the state CIO's office. And so we'll talk. And right now, that said, the statute says July 1st of 2015. The discussion earlier about the FAA's ruling, originally they were planned for July of 2015, then it slid to September. Now we think it's November. But given this lawsuit, there may be some interest on their part to bring some clarity sooner. So, again, those are all decisions that need to come from the FAA, and we'd just be guessing if we tried to determine what their exact position is. The picture on the slide is one that many of you probably seen, is the Amazon delivering packages. And currently that would not be allowed in North Carolina if Amazon did want to do that. There's also something that you've heard to, and I'll speak to, is called a COA. It's the Certificate of Authorization that some of the other speakers have referred to, and that is issued by the FAA. To my knowledge, there's only three of those issued in North Carolina at this time, and that's to the NGAT. So the NGAT is a program out of NC State. I think you've had Kyle present in previous sessions, so I won't go into too much detail. They actually are approved to fly in three specific counties, and certain planes have also been provided this COA, as our previous presenter offered. So that's the only group that we've authorized from the state CIO's office to fly unmanned air systems in North Carolina. The report that we were asked to produce was part of the budget bill, and it was due March 1st and submitted on March 1st as requested. And so I'll walk through those sections of the report now, and you're welcome to read it in great detail through the link on the website. Just to thank a large group of participants that participated in the report. They've met several times a month, walking through the various uses of this technology, various business issues. As you can see, there was a good population, cross-functional group of agency members, law enforcement, technologists, etc. The report's primary finding first is safety in the air and on the ground. So the team felt, as the FAA, is the number one priority is safety, and the concerns that the first presentation talked about, the avoidance systems. It's not necessarily the avoidance systems on the unmanned air systems. It's many of the manned air systems do not have that same technology because of some of the age of that equipment. So a small Cessna plane may not have a avoidance technology that our unmanned air systems would have. So that's something to consider. So I also personally have talked to several folks, including I think one of the presenters here, which was the captain of the Highway Patrol, that was concerned about safety of his pilots as they were coming in for approach landing. So clearly safety considerations are important, but not something we can't work around. We just need to be mindful of it. As far as data management, as many of the presenters have presented to this committee, we're really using technology in ways that we've never intended to use technology, and that's the really exciting part for me as the state chief information officer. But it also comes with it is the production of large data sets. And so if you start to think, why is the state chief information officer involved in looking at UAS, it's really just another data collector. And every day we work and manage large volumes of information on behalf of the citizens of North Carolina. We secure it, we protect it, we know who has access to it. And so the same would be true for our unmanned air systems and the data that they might produce, is to make sure that it meets our public records laws, that it is controlled and available to the public as appropriate if the public's paid for it, et cetera. So these are some of the considerations the team worked through in the data management category. It would not be a good presentation on this topic if we didn't talk about citizen privacy and protection. As many of the other presenters have talked about, there's a wide range of public sentiment on this, from much of the public being supportive as much as it being concerned. So there's both extremes, and I leave it to the members to decide what the appropriate level of usage is. That we're just reporting what we saw. The good news is there's a number of existing laws. I think the committee had a presentation earlier on that this year where he went through some of the laws that already exist in North Carolina that would be available to protect citizens and their privacy and this technology flying outside people's homes. As far as potential uses for government, the report went in through a large potential use list. This is just a snapshot of some of those uses. The agricultural presentation you just heard, a lot about public safety and supporting firefighters, for example. It's a lot safer to put an unmanned air system over a fire than a manned flight. So some of those become quite easy to see. And then you heard the other presenters talk about cost, so I won't go into all those details. As far as the economic benefit, the report did work with the Commerce Department, who also identified some opportunities for job growth in North Carolina. And there is several reports that indicate that there's a great opportunity for North Carolina for job growth. I think the two presenters before me outlined that opportunity much more than I can. But the report does go into some of that economic development opportunity for the state. As far as the governance and operations in the state, we identified six areas that we think the members should consider as part of a governance model for the state. I'll walk through each of those. First is the FAA. They would govern all UAS operations. The next would be our primary recommendation in the report, which is a UAS governing body. That governing body would help establish the policies and procedures in the state of North Carolina that's not covered specifically by statute that the members pick to elect to use. The next role would be our university systems and our education environment, because we have a great asset here with NC State and what they're doing with NGAT. There's a wonderful opportunity to be on the beginning edge of this industry and build the opportunity for North Carolina.
I'm trying to determine where all the feedback's coming from, and I think it's this press microphone that's been put up here. Let's see if I take...
It's that microphone.
Yeah, but that one's getting our recording, so I think the wireless is what's causing the feedback.
I don't think so. But
no. No. We don't turn this one down.
We appreciate
it. It seems to be getting worse. Is why we're
we all
do that.
Now
it is.
I've already had an excessive migraine, so I don't need one.
It wasn't
like
when we first started meeting,
it wasn't
here.
Can Chris just talk really loud? Yeah.
I talk really loud?
Yeah.
I got it back on.
Is that still better? Or?
No, it's still doing it. See, well, yeah, because this microphone's still on, right?
Yes.
The recording is? Okay. If you try it without that and see if you're loud enough.
Okay. I'll try to talk louder. Everybody in the back got me back there? Yeah, we got hands up. Okay. So UAS Air Systems then would also have the agencies involved in the governance roles. And I'm having a hard time reading my next slide, too. Emergency management slide. So the emergency management folks would be involved in this in the event of an emergency. As one option would be, like the first presenter talked about, how those assets would be managed by a private company and could be relocated on behalf of the state. Or if the state owned those assets, we think that putting those unmanned air systems in flight in the event of a hurricane cleanup event or something like that, that these would be made available for emergency management purposes. And then the last piece is the information sharing group. Law enforcement has a training center, and much like you would train law enforcement on how to use a radar gun, we would want to make sure that the law enforcement had the proper training and certifications if the members elected to let them use this technology. As far as the governance board, some of the duties and responsibilities that we thought the board would have would primarily be able to develop a repeatable process. We modeled this much after the 911 board, which is also out of the state CIO's office. So we use that as a model when trying to determine some of the stakeholders. As you read the report, you'll see that the recommended structure of that board resembles 911's board. We also think that there should be some exception handling processes. So the board would establish some exception handling processes for emergencies and those type of situations that none of us could foresee as we develop law.
Can we jump in?
Yes, sir.
Please, can you explain, is the governance board up and running? How is it going to be created? Is that something internal you're on, or is that something that needs to be legislated?
Yes, sir. The question is the governance board. So the governance board does not exist today, and we proposed it in the report, and it would be up to the members to decide if you felt you wanted to create it or not.
Through legislation.
Yes, sir. As far as public outreach and communications, this event today, much like many that need to be with the citizens, is to explain the technology, how it can be used. There was an interesting 60 Minutes last night that I had a chance to watch also that's even newer than the one that was referenced in the earlier presentation, where it talked about the small vehicles, and it was a very good opportunity to learn about the technology. If you haven't had a chance to see it, I'm sure it's on the 60 Minutes website. We also have some assets in the state that we think can be involved in education. NGAT is kind of our central group that seems
the most logical place to continue helping with education. They're working under budgeting from a DOT that was in the state budget, and then we think continuing our relationship with the state CIO's office and making sure that the information gathered is protected and secure and consistent with the laws that the state has asked us to follow. As far as costing and funding, this was just an initial assessment of where we think some of the cost and cost models. Initially, we're recommending the governance board would resemble the 911 board, so there's an executive director who runs that and a staff person to allow that group to set up all the policies, procedures. It's going to be a little bit of effort, so there's some reference to that in the material. And then there's also some options on how you might fund this long-term if you wanted to have some kind of receipt model where you charge permitting or flight fees, something along those lines. So there's some recommendations in the report as options for the members to consider. Again, we're in new territory. There's not a model to go pull off from another state to follow. So we tried to use some of the programs that are currently in the state as a benchmark as we made recommendations on how you might cost and fund some of these programs. Legislation considerations. The first one is, as the chair presented, is the actually creation of the board. In the meantime, we'll continue to operate under the current law, which is the state CIO's authority. And as I mentioned, only one group has actually been given that, which is NGAP. Our first priority is that if we're going to issue the flight authorization, is that they have a COA, which so FAA would issue the COA, and then we would issue our guidance. And that'll be in place until the board is put in place if you elect to move that way. Also, some of the other recommendations for legislation is to consider the existing manned flight laws as a potential benchmark for unmanned air flight. The group felt that it's possible to put more laws in place over unmanned air systems that may hinder manned flights in the future. So being mindful of what decisions are made for unmanned air systems may affect manned flights. Establish standards for data management and retention, and this would be as far back as public records request, costs for these records, how are they stored, who has access to them. It would be helpful for me if you brought some clarity around that as we have to manage that. Address the time that information is stored. There's various data collectors around the state that store data at different times. Traffic cameras, for example, store lots of data, and then some of them store it forever, some of them store it for a year, so there's a lot of inconsistency on the length of time data is stored. The group felt that given our strong military presence in North Carolina that we need to create a good partnership with them and keep them informed of flights that would occur around their installations. And then the last recommendation was continue to understand what happens when commercial flights are allowed and how this technology would complement and work closely with the manned flights. So that was a quick summary of the report. It's happy to answer questions from the members now.
Questions from the committee. Representative Tolson.
Can you give us three or four key items that you think that we ought to be doing right now?
Mr. Chairman, please. I think the key item is to make sure we have funding to continue to research and study this technology so that we can continue to develop it in a way that's meaningful to North Carolina. That'd be one. I think two then would be thinking about the safety and privacy concerns that people have and make sure that we are mindful of those and that we have laws that protect the citizens on that front.
Representative Whitmire.
Suggestion, you mentioned the storage of data. Some data may have a very purposeful long-term use. Talking about the cosmic analysis of agricultural soils and some of the colorful slides we saw there. You know, from year to year, that's probably good information to reflect back on. However, there's plenty of other items that need to have a short shelf life. and that gets into privacy and purpose. So certainly it's not a one-size-fits-all, but I think that would be a very key, not exactly easy, piece to delve into, but having shelf lives for sure on various categories of data. I'm sure y'all are thinking that way, but we have to do that at DOD when we're just simply doing a hurricane analysis of where to put assets to put first responders in this area versus that area. The shelf life on that data aerial imagery is very short because it doesn't really serve a purpose after a certain time. Suggestion.
Response?
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good feedback. Appreciate the feedback. I will tell you, we manage also out of the state CIO's office the mapping, the GIS mapping. So we're used to collecting aerial photography and storing it for long periods of time and making it available for consumption by various users. I would also say that with the NGAT, one of our agreements was if they, in their testing out at Hyde County or any other location, if they capture a human without their consent, they have to delete those records. So if they're doing an emergency management situation, then they would have consent of those people that they capture. So we did think about that, at least initially, in our authorization to fly. Long term, that would be up to the members to decide how and what data you'd want us to store for what periods of time.
Follow up? Further questions or comments from the committee?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Please stay. There,
yes, sir.
There may be further questions. Have the members all seen their email today? There was a draft of a potential bill that Susan put together regarding this subject matter. Have all of you seen it? Do you have copies of it? Susan's going to put it out on the website. Now, this is just a preliminary draft that has not been discussed among the committee members, but Susan graciously pulled bits and pieces of other states' legislation and merged it into something for us to discuss. Is that correct?
That's correct. It is not a statement of what should be done, rather an identification of issues that other states have addressed and how they have addressed them, just to facilitate a starting point for discussion.
And before we start into the committee, are there any comments from the public at this time?
Mr. Chair.
Please, if you will approach the mic so everyone have an opportunity to hear you. And we have, well, Susan has successfully eliminated the feedback, and for that, we are most grateful.
The microphone off is how we've eliminated it. So you'll have to talk loud.
I'll try and project. All right. Well, good afternoon. My name is Sarah Preston. I'm with the ACLU of North Carolina, and since we were referenced in one of the presentations, I felt like I better get up here and say something. I am the policy director for the ACLU of North Carolina. We are a nonprofit, as was mentioned. We're nonpartisan, and we're membership-based. We have 11,000 members, approximately, in the state, and about 500,000 in the nation. And we are very, very concerned about privacy issues. It's one of our most important issues that we work on in a variety of fields. And because we know that a lot of law enforcement agencies are interested in unmanned aerial vehicles, commonly known as drones, and we know that the proliferation of drones is coming, we are very interested in getting some protections on the books to protect people's privacy as soon as possible. We actually commissioned a poll just last week, which we got the results from, just to find out how North Carolinian voters feel about requiring a warrant for law enforcement to conduct surveillance of individuals. And we found out that 72% of North Carolinians agree with us that there should be a warrant requirement, and only 13% disagree with that. So we think that the public is generally with us. It is not, as you've heard, a vocal minority, but in fact, a pretty concerned majority of North Carolinians that are concerned about their privacy when it comes to drones. We believe that House Bill 312, the Preserving Privacy Act of 2013, struck the appropriate balance for use of drones by prohibiting the use of drones by any person or government agency for gathering evidence or other information or data pertaining to criminal conduct. But without a warrant, but explicitly allowing the use of drones by government agencies for any purposes other than gathering evidence. This exception could include anything from agricultural mapping, which we heard about, or even traffic control. We also understand that there need to be reasonable exceptions to the warrant requirements, and that's why we supported House Bill 312, which provided that if law enforcement had reasonable suspicion that someone's life would be at risk, like a hostage situation or standoff, or to pursue a fleeing suspect or protect property, that should be allowed. As more and more law enforcement and government agencies within North Carolina express an interest in drones, and the use of drones by both government and private businesses and individuals spreads across the country, we think it's imperative that North Carolina, like almost a dozen other states, make sure that privacy is protected. We would urge you not only to include a clear warrant requirement, but also to include a warrant requirement for law enforcement seeking data from privately owned and operated drones. We do not want to see law enforcement work around any requirements that this committee puts in place or recommends by simply requesting the information from a private company or individual. So we hope that the committee will agree with the majority of North Carolinians and adopt recommendations that will protect the privacy of all North Carolinians. And I thank you very much for the opportunity to speak.
We'll stay for a second. Sure. Are there any questions for Ms. Preston? Representative Fairclough.
It sounds like what you all are asking for as far as ACLU concerns on this is very close to the way law enforcement in North Carolina operates anyway. I can't see any real areas of confrontation there. I think we can certainly work that out so that the public feels that they are protected and law enforcement still has the tools that it needs. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. One of the things we've tried to make clear all along is that we understand there are legitimate uses for unmanned aerial vehicles, and we aren't trying to prohibit things that are going to help with search and rescue or standoffs or hostage situations, anything like that. We just want to make sure that when you're collecting evidence about a person, you know, actually surveilling or following them around, that you've gotten a warrant. And I think that helps law enforcement because then they know that whatever evidence they've collected is admissible. They're not going to find themselves in a situation where a court says, oh, no, you weren't abiding by the law.
Any further questions? Thank you. We appreciate your time. Any additional members from the audience like to speak on this matter at this time? Hearing none, we will begin our discussion. Representative Moffitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are four areas that I'd like to get more information about, or areas that we need to consider. The word autonomous to me means more independent, self-governing, and I think that we need to be careful in drafting this legislation that we maintain the human elements, the flying of these unmanned aerial vehicles, and stipulate that it's under the control of a person for not only safety reasons, but accountability reasons. I think we need to include that in the legislation. Secondly, if a person in agriculture is using these for the examples that we've seen, I would not like them to be subject to a on-demand request from law enforcement that they turn over their data just so that law enforcement can see what they have seen or perhaps see what is going on an adjacent property. So I think some protection needs to be created regarding that on-demand request has to be included with a warrant or a subpoena or what have you. Curtilage, we discussed it briefly at our first meeting. I still do not have a good, clear definition of what that is. I've talked to different people in law enforcement, and everybody gives me a different answer. So I think that's something from a privacy standpoint that we need to really take a look at. I've gone through our statutes, and curtilage is mentioned quite a bit, but I'm not sure that I have actually found the definition as to what it is. And lastly, on the naked eye limitation, we discussed that again, I think, at the end of our first meeting in regards to the, I guess, and Ms. Sykes discussed that the first time, the first meeting, if you remember that law enforcement is limited to what they see by the naked eye as an incidental. If they're in the process of executing a warrant, I guess, and they see something driving through the neighborhood by their naked eye, then they can act upon that. But they really can't use any additional surveillance that's not intended for the execution of that warrant. Is that correct?
No.
What? I just need more information about that.
If they're acting on a warrant and the information, they can use cameras, telescopic, whatever, to see whatever they need to see pursuant to that warrant. It's only if they are, say, for example, in a manned aircraft doing a flyover property. If they see a plot of marijuana, that's good. If they have to zoom in with the camera to see the guy sitting on his back porch smoking a joint, that's not. So if they're operating on a warrant, that's not an issue. It's only the, you know, things that they just might see in the course of doing, you know, executing a warrant somewhere else. If they see something that the warrant doesn't apply to, then it's a fine line, and in some cases it's very subjective as to what is okay and what is not. But in a general sense, in most cases, enhanced viewing is not okay, not with the warrant.
Follow up. Is that stated clearly somewhere?
No, not really.
Okay.
Most of that whole area of law is based on case law. And North Carolina, like most states, are very hesitant to try to put exact criteria and statutes because it is such a case-by-case basis that's based on U.S. Supreme Court interpretation of the Constitution and what is an illegal search and seizure pursuant to the Fourth Amendment. So kind of the same thing with your curtilage, a little bit different issue. That is not clearly defined, and to my knowledge, no state clearly defines it because it also is kind of based on case law and is a case-by-case determination of whether or not something truly fits in within the curtilage based on the actual facts of what it, where it is on the property, what it's for, and how it's used, and all of that.
Mr. Chair, can I follow up on Representative Moffitt's question, please?
By all means.
Just on that same line, how would you, because that whole Fourth Amendment case law, as you know, has evolved over the last few years. There's been expansions and limitations. How would you draft something to try to define, statutorily curtilage
of
that? How would you do that?
Well, I wouldn't unless you make me. To be quite honest.
I'm just wondering mechanically if there's a way that you feel like
I think
you guys are the best and brightest lawyers in the state of North Carolina.
Well, I appreciate that, but I think that you're setting the state and the courts of the state up in a less than ideal situation if you try to define a term like that that is universally undefined as far as a set definition. It is defined in a sense by case law, and there are plenty of cases that say, yes, this is curtilage, no, this is not curtilage, but it's still kind of a very open thing. I would not want to try to do it unless you try to make me do it, and then I'm happy to read case law after case law and try to come up with something, but inevitably, with that type of thing, you end up with some scenario that you didn't think about. And same thing, you know, with Fourth Amendment search and seizure in general. It's kind of just an established principle that it is a case by case. There's some general guidelines. You know, you have to have a warrant except, but it's just a really hard thing to nail down in specific terms.
Representative Fairclough.
One step further on that. I think a real-life example that we can imagine would be if I were sitting here operating the computer and flying a plane around, let's say, for looking for ice damage, like last week. We were using it for that purpose. But I happen to be a law enforcement officer. And suddenly I see through the vision of that aircraft two people standing there and what looks like a gun going off and one of them falling. Now, you obviously can't say, okay, now I got to run and get a warrant before I can look at that any further. You also wonder if you can say, I can't zoom in on that. So this is a very nebulous area we're dealing with, and I certainly agree with everyone that's mentioned it. We've got to be very careful. but we also have to be realistic in how we approach it, because the last thing we want to do is be so careful that we are unable to help a citizen who needs help. So it's not going to be an easy task, but I think it can be done.
Thank you. Representative Torbett.
Thanks. I don't want to miss an opportunity to use the word curtilage, so I was going to ask Representative Moffitt and Representative Moore if they're going to look at new legislation that more clearly defines that. Would the first thing you look at be changing the term to a more common day term?
Lord, I hope not.
We'll take another time.
Representative Whitmire.
Question. Representative Torbett, you said this, I think it's in the first meeting. You know, there are folks out there that no matter how well we have a statute that protects privacy, they're going to take their chances and pay the price. We talked about putting a little bit more teeth into some of those prices, if you want to call it that, whether it's civil or whatever. I just get them to an area that I'm not. I'm not an attorney. Have y'all had that discussion? Is that we probably can't do everything we want to, but on the other hand, as far as putting some stiffer penalties into those who choose to blatantly disregard what the law is, have y'all had that yet?
Representative Torbett.
That's the purpose of the committee having some deliberation. We talk about such dastardly acts. I think Jeffrey made a comment, plug in old Sparky again. I mean, if you're going to have a law and you're going to have repercussions, you've got to have enough teeth in the law that, number one, it works as a very, especially with some of the issues we're dealing with, a very strong deterrent. So people would look at that and say, it's not worth it. So, yeah, I think that's some of the discussion we need to have, whether we, on some of the legality, go from more civil to a criminal, whether it be, you know, misdemeanor, first offense, some type of degree. I'm not the smartest guy in the world about the degrees of felonies, but maybe the next step up and just keep ratcheting up the more times that. And I think for the privacy issue, I think that'd be big. We talked about how it applies to some of the peeping laws. So maybe you can strengthen some of the peeping laws by knowing that it might be through an unmanned systems element now. That's an opportunity this committee has full range of discussion.
Just information-wise, depending on what someone does with an unmanned aircraft, obviously if they use it to peep into someone's home through the window, it doesn't matter they're using an unmanned aircraft, they're standing on live with their camera. That's a violation of our law. If they took it and they rammed it into a manned aircraft to cause a plane crash, it doesn't matter that they threw something up in the air or they floated an unmanned aircraft, that's going to be a violation of some law. The real question, I think, is are you going to criminalize, you know, I decide to put my little unmanned aircraft up and fly it around the neighborhood, and in the process I catch my neighbor nude sunbathing, you know. Assuming I don't do anything with that picture, like put it up on the internet or something, I just take it, is that going to be a crime, or is it just going to be a civil cause of action between me and my neighbor that my neighbor sues me because I did that? And that's a decision for y'all to make. You can choose to do that. I will tell you that looking at the other states who have actually enacted statutes so far, that does not seem to be the trend. The trend seems to be to just specifically state that there is a civil cause of action for an unmanned use. I mean, I'm talking private use, not... and in some cases, government use when you're not talking about being used for a criminal prosecution. So it's not, as of right now, there's no case law that prohibits it. I mean, you can make it a crime to spy on your neighbor in that way, but that doesn't seem to be the trend unless they do something more intrusive, like peep through a window in the house or, you know, go into a clearly kind of confined area or whatever. But just happen to fly around the neighborhood and get people's backyards or take a picture of somebody, the trend seems to be more just a civil cause of action.
Representative Ford.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I may be able to get it here today, a little more technical information on, they were talking about collision avoidance. I'd like to learn more about that and the possibility of possibly crashing with manned or other unmanned aircraft. They were talking about possibly in 5 years, 20 or 30,000 of these things flying around, and with communication towers, et cetera, or just falling out of the sky. I mean, I'd like to learn more about that aspect of it.
Well, we don't really have time to learn. Kyle, I don't know if Kyle can maybe address some of that now. I will just remind the committee, because we're an LRC, we're only allowed 4 meetings. This is our third, which means next meeting we have to adopt a report, if you wish to adopt a report. Well, we have to adopt some kind of report, whether or not it has recommendations. And we have to send that report to you out in writing 7 days before the next meeting. So today is the day to decide, at least in general sense, what kind of recommendations you want us to do a draft of. Kyle may be able to answer some of those questions, but we do not have additional meetings to provide that information. So I don't know if the chair would like to recognize Kyle.
Kyle, we are happy to recognize you. Bless your heart. Please.
Yes, Marty.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Expect current operations in the near future from MEFA legislation to require line of sight operations.
Identify yourself.
Yes. Kyle Snyder, the director of the Next Gen Air Transportation Center at NC State. The line of sight operations require Class 2 medical vision, so you can always see about 2-3 miles out, depending on the size of the aircraft. If the aircraft gets smaller, you're going to keep it closer. The agriculture operations are a good application for that, because we're seeing that even the little bird that we're flying right now is 3 pounds. I don't see that out past a mile, so we have to keep it close. We've got to keep our people staggered out through the fields. Going beyond line of sight, the FAA has no current plans for that. The Alaris presentation, of course, was all autonomous situations with the man in the loop being back at a control station. Those operations are beyond line of sight, and that is the research we would have to do with the FAA to say this is how this can safely integrate. Technologies for the bigger aviation questions, much like Representative Faircloth is interested in, how are unmanned aircraft working with current aviation systems? Automatic dependent surveillance broadcast, GPS-based navigation, is one method for doing that. That is the backbone of the FAA's next-gen program. Without that connectivity, you won't see aircraft-to-aircraft communications, whether they're manned or unmanned. And that is certainly the direction that, that this is going in. 4G networks are another tool that that some of these UAS providers and other aviation providers are looking at for data management, including communications and awareness of what's going on in airspace. So operations in the near future, law enforcement is outside of any kind of urban environment anytime soon. With the agriculture, the emergency response, the reaching out into the more rural areas, collision via line of sight is the preferred sense and avoid method. But I can certainly spend more time with this if you'd like to know more.
Members of the committee, Representative Tolson.
Mr. Chairman, as we are developing these policies and procedures and recommendations, I hope that we will give a lot of thought to it being we're trying to develop an industry in North Carolina. We're trying to make sure that we have policies and procedures that advance these companies or these developments or these processes or want to come here and not develop procedures that said, well, we don't want to go to North Carolina. Let's go somewhere else. They've made it so stringent. So I hope that can be a part of our process because certainly, as we've heard, this is going to be a big industry somewhere. And we certainly love to have it in North Carolina.
Thank you. Representative Moffitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 312, which I think was the catalyst for the establishment of this LRC, have we got any feedback regarding what's in that particular bill as far as objectionable from either industry or law enforcement?
I have not.
Yes, sir.
But we're about to hear that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The interest is has been reviewed by the law enforcement community and is under consideration. They're most concerned that we still aren't quite ready yet, even with the governance plan as it is, that they need more time to develop the appropriate structures.
much like Susan has presented, that the case law for defining cartilage and how things are integrated there needs to be determined. So the law enforcement working group that helps support the governance plan has asked for an additional year before anybody in the law enforcement community across the street, across the state, would be interested in integrating these technologies. So because of House Bill 312 and the rest of the governance plan has come together, they're looking for more time. But the other agencies, I guess, are fine with it as it is for supporting the governance plan.
Follow up. When you say that they're asking for more time, are they asking for the legislature to take no action?
No, they are fine with the governance plan as it applies to other agencies, just not law enforcement. So basically, inside the current law enforcement structure, inside the current governance plan, the governance board would not expect any law enforcement agency to come forward and say, we want to fly and ask for the CIO's approval. They're, as a community, they're saying, we want more time.
Representative Speciale.
I think it's a good idea to keep law enforcement on hold. Because the most important thing in all of this,
okay, for the
it's important that, you know, that we, whatever we do helps to enhance the business side of it, the economic side of it. But the very most important thing we need to do is make sure that the citizens' privacy is protected. Length of time that they can keep videos and photos for law enforcement when they do. I mean, there's a lot of questions for law enforcement that we've got to respond to. So I think whatever we come up with, because it will be time intensive with regard to law enforcement, that we do leave that alone and deal with everything else. But I think criminal and civil actions for any willful violations or whatever we come up with, from the law enforcement side, or from the peeping and all this other garbage that people are going to inevitably do, the penalties do need to be harsh enough to ensure that they won't just pay the fine and go ahead and do it.
Thank you. Representative Fairclough.
Would it be possible if members of the committee wanted to see one of the aircraft at work? We could go to one of your fields and visit it someday. It's going to be spring someday.
We have permission to fly at Butner, the NC State beef cattle farm. We've got one aircraft we can fly there. We've got another request in with the FAA to fly that one. So I'm more than happy to host a demonstration at an appropriate time, whenever it works for members of the committee. But we can do that. We've got permission from the FAA, so really kind of any time it works, as soon as it warms up and it's dry.
I would ask the chair to consider arranging that.
Can you land one in the mall behind this building?
No.
That's unfortunate for us. Chairman Torbert.
I think it might be easier for the committee. It's easier for me, I'll speak for myself, that instead of going way out the weeds, think of from the viewpoint of law enforcement, probable cause, obtaining a warrant. Think what they have to go through today to do that without the use of an unmanned system. Now, integrate an unmanned system in. Essentially, all you're doing is where the law enforcement may have cameras, video technology today to do that surveillance. There's no difference between that technology and just simply putting it on an unmanned vehicle, if you want to think of it in that respect. It's just the unmanned system may be more mobile, for example. But as far as the imagery, the data collection, they have a way to collect that now through the process of obtaining a warrant. I personally have no issue carrying that process if you're thinking of the unmanned system simply as just another tool in law enforcement's toolbox. So they would still have to go have a warrant. Some of the language has come down before. When you go into other government agencies, which is in, I think it's in the language, is that other government agencies is agriculture. My big concern is that if you're flying from a field or a landing strip A, and you're trying to get to Joe's agriculture spot D, and you're going to cross over B and C, is that
that's a flight line. That really shouldn't be a very high concern. And you probably went ahead and got the permission from Joe D, or he hired you to come fly over his property to give him some agricultural data and intelligence. So I think if we look at law enforcement from just the UAV just being another tool or toolbox, we can, as we talked about in our first meeting, use some of the existing laws and just, if you feel a need, to just incorporate the term unmanned air vehicle or unmanned air system, or the antiquated term that everyone still likes to use, drone. Then we can work within the laws that we have or the confines that we have without creating another wheel, so to speak. Going into the private sector, I agree, it is an emerging economy. It's actually been out there for quite a while, but it seems like the push now is to get it out through our Federal Aviation Administration. The gentleman spoke first from Thailand. One of the things that holds back us from growth, not speaking disrespectfully of our brothers at the federal level, the Federal Aviation Administration, is that places like Thailand and Pakistan and Iraq and Iran and some of the sandbox countries we use this, they don't have Federal Aviation Administration that they have to go through. So that gives some of these other countries an edge because they don't have the necessary hurdles and requirements and regulatory process that we have to go through here because of Federal Aviation Administration, which is good because they're in the safety business. That being said, we need to keep an eye on the economics of this and let that engine kind of drive itself once we feel like we've protected privacy, which I believe we can under current law, with perhaps slight modifications by simply inserting UAV titles or language and changing that word y'all were using earlier, curlage or something, changing that so it's more commonplace. But we can go way out in the weeds, or we can stay right home with simply thinking it as another tool in the toolbox. There's nothing that this air vehicle can do that can't simply be done now, except it's more mobile. You can get an Cessna 150 today or any small plane and do the same type of things today, currently, with no restrictions. None. And the only difference is that you're sitting in the plane versus sitting behind a console and that plane somewhere else. That's the only difference. So think of it from that respect. You could go out today and assess the 150 and surveil somebody, and essentially there's no law that I understand out there that prohibits you from doing that as a private citizen. So think of it from that respect. The only difference is you're not sitting in this plane, you are sitting in this plane.
I'd like to state a follow-up to that, but you have to consider the privacy of the industry of the business sector, because, for example, if someone has a pipe company, it's very labor-intensive, it's open, it covers several 60 to 80 acres, and if somebody's buzzing that property in a plane, you can see them. Somebody's buzzing it with a drone, trying to look at whatever manufacturing capabilities that particular business has, you may not know it's there. And they can go when you're not there. I mean, I know you have the peeping laws as well, but you have to, and the privacy issue I find very very much a pivot point here. Someone in their yard, someone in their business, their private property, and the draft bill addresses that, but everyone hasn't seen that, but that's just my two cents. Representative Fulton.
You can read a license plate from the geosynchronous satellite already. That makes this a moot point, The other question is, in the bill it mentioned the court of competent jurisdiction having say-so about a lot of things, handling warrant, handling the record, keeping whether or not it's actually relatively pertinent to the issue and so forth. And, you know, in the case of NSA surveillance, the FISA court was established to brought kind of national security issues. Now, I don't want to get down that road, but the question is, do you have certain parts of the judiciary in this state that can handle this type of privacy information, but handling without having to go to, I assume, a competent court, a competent jurisdiction in the law as it's written now, at least in the 312, means any court. Is that correct? Does any court have a competent jurisdiction, like a district court, or what do you mean by competent jurisdiction in this case?
There are jurisdictional rules for what courts can hear what types of action, and sometimes that type is based on a money amount. Sometimes that type is based on criminal or civil. It might be subject matter jurisdiction. It might be location. You know, if you're in a civil case, where that case can be brought depends on where the parties live or where the action happened. So there are rules that determine whether or not a court is competent to have jurisdiction over that particular matter. So any court could be a court of competent jurisdiction, but may not necessarily be, depending on what that court's jurisdictional guidelines are.
So in that case, a court of competent jurisdiction may not know much about the subject matter at hand, about the issues involving surveillance and drone, collection of data, recording of data, maintenance of recorded materials, how long it should be contained. In other words, is there some special focus we should ask of the judiciary branch to develop that type of response? Or expertise to say, if you're going to be handling these types of cases, maybe you can have some kind of specialty area that handles it without having to go down and invent the wheel and, you know, the eastern part of the state and the western part of the state in various small court jurisdictions where they may not know the issue or haven't had it discussed already. And there are courts that are specialty courts to do that in the state for other purposes.
And you're correct. I mean, we have business courts. You know, in most cases, it's going to be what judge you're actually in front of, and there are some judges that have specializations and say things like they've done extra training in juvenile law or that sort of stuff. It's certainly possible going forward that y'all could set something like that up, particularly if it becomes apparent it's going to be a large caseload.
Chair Torbett.
Thank you. Following to Chairman Setzer's comments, he's exactly right with the individual privacy issues. Perhaps there's some way we can incorporate not only with the laws we have that we cover some of that. We spoke earlier is that if you're actively surveilling an individual or an individual's property or entity, we'll say an entity could be a corporate entity or an individual entity. It's going to be hard to know that somebody's doing that in some cases. Very true. So it's what you do with that data is where the law is broken. So if you disseminate that data, if you put me breaking my leaves on YouTube and you didn't ask my permission for it, then I ought to have some type of recourse. I think the punishment should be, of course, equal to the crime. So if you put a picture of me breaking my leaves on YouTube, perhaps that's not criminal, although it could be. If you're doing something that's more pervasive and it's perhaps this isn't your first time, then I think you need to bump up to the criminal. We have to make the point that people just don't want to actually do this stuff. But it's not so much the collecting of the data, although that needs to be in the language, it's how it's disseminated. What's that person's reason for doing this? And what did he do with that information? And I think that's the part that we need to cover with prior approval or signed document or whatever, permission.
Representative Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think we're beginning to get too involved with this situation. We're going to bog ourselves down if we're not careful. For instance, if Charlie lived next door to Susie, and Charlie's 16 years old, or I'll say 18 years old, he takes his stepladder and puts it up against Susie's fence after dark and looks in at Susie's window. And he's caught. He's guilty of being a thieving cop. Everybody understands that. Simple law. If his daddy flies a helicopter for the state and the helicopter is up a block and a half away hovering and his daddy is looking with a pair of binoculars through Susie's window at her, he's just as guilty. The same law would apply. It doesn't require any more law. There are some things we'll have to provide for. But for goodness sakes, let's not get so bogged down that we come up short in the good things we get out of this business.
Representative Moffitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that's an excellent point. Without having a law enforcement background myself or one in criminal law, a lot of these laws that we're talking about or a lot of the questions that we have are probably already answered in the code somewhere. And I would like staff to kind of walk us through that over the next few weeks via email, so we're not out there reinventing a wheel that's already been created, because I don't particularly know those sets of statutes. So if we could have staff patiently work with us, that would be great. And we will not compel a new definition of curling in exchange.
Please.
If I could.
Absolutely.
I provided you at a previous meeting, and I'm happy to provide it again via email, the statutes that I thought specifically might have some application, you know, if a UAS was used, would also apply. I think there's probably a lot of other statutes that if somebody used an UAS to do it would also apply, but they aren't as obviously applicable. Like, as I mentioned, you know, taking a... running it into an airplane or into the side of a house and destroying property. That, you know, that's destruction of property, and it doesn't matter that you used a UAS as opposed to a sledgehammer, you know, or intentionally drove your car through it or whatever. So there's probably a lot of particularly criminal statutes that would apply that just because you use a UAS doesn't matter. I don't think that I can go through and tell you what all those are. If you have specific questions about would this be prohibited under current law, I mean, laws that already apply to whether or not you can take photographs or what you can do with photographs and stuff like that, that's not going to change just because you're using a UAS to take those photographs as opposed to standing with a camera or setting a video camera up somewhere or that sort of stuff. I think the biggest question that well, there's several big questions, but the biggest questions that the committee needs to think about have largely been brought up. Law enforcement usage, is there going to be a warrant requirement, and are there going to be exceptions to that? Are you going to provide exception? And one of the things in the draft that I did, and again, I'm not advocating for this, but that a lot of states have done, is they provided an exception for emergency situations where swift action needs to be taken to prevent loss of life, to prevent major destruction of property. Somebody's missing in the woods. You may not necessarily want law enforcement to have to go to a court and get a warrant to put the UAS up to search for the missing 2-year-old that's wandered off into the woods and it's 8 o'clock at night in January. You know, those are the so you've got the law enforcement perspective and what they should be able to do with these with or without a warrant. And then you have the private perspective, which is really twofold. You've got the commercial usage, which you've heard a lot about today. You know, the agriculture usage, you know, whether or not Amazon wants to start delivering packages using UAS, you know, that sort of stuff, and whether or not that should be allowed. And if I'm, you know, going to fly to Farmer Joe's field to survey it, do I have to have the permission of farmers Ben, John, and Jake that I've got to cross their property to get there? Or do I have to not turn the camera on until I get to Farmer Joe's or, you know, what? And then on top of that, you've got, you know, the teenage boy that wants to spy on everybody in the neighborhood just out of curiosity, but isn't going to actually go up to a window and peep. He's just going to, you know, survey the backyards and see who's doing what and what kind of consequences you want to result from that, whether you want that to be criminal or whether you just want, you know, there to be a suit. Do you want to prohibit that completely, or do you want to, as the Representative Torbett suggested, say it only depends on what they do with any information or data they take. But I think that any existing criminal conduct, anything that's already illegal, is going to continue to be illegal if somebody uses a UAS, I think is the main point. So it's really deciding how to allow the beneficial usages and provide some guidance so that you discourage at least the intrusive and privacy-violating usages that you don't want to happen. So, Representative Moffitt, that's a long-winded way of saying, if you have specific questions about what is and isn't allowed, I am happy to email with you all day long and help you figure that out. I don't think that I can provide you with a comprehensive overview without some direction about what your particular interests are.
Follow up.
Do we need to reference these in the new section that we're creating? Just for clarification.
I have looked at, you know, the statutes that I'm aware of that I thought had the most logical application to UAS possibly being used. it's my opinion that possibly with the exception of the electronic surveillance statutes, which we have, which only deal with audio surveillance, not picture, I don't believe that it's necessary to specifically say, and if you do this using a UAS, it is a violation, because you're going to, like as I said, regardless of what you use to do it, you still will have met the requirements of the criminal law. I don't really think it's necessary in the electronic surveillance statutes, but that's the one instance where, because it sets out some different electronic criteria, I could, you know, say maybe you might want to put it in that one. I think it's more, and like I said, the draft that I did, and again, I'm not advocating for it, I made the decision to do a totally separate statute. It just says, in general, UAS, this is what you can and can't do. I think it makes sense to have it in one place as far as a general overriding recommendation. If you choose to create the governance board that Mr. Estes' study is recommending, then obviously we might put it in a different location from where I did a draft. I just kind of found a logical place in the criminal statute, since some of it was warrant requirement. The other thing that, a little off track, that I'll just mention, the committee does not have to recommend a draft. I did a draft because I was looking at other states' drafts and just pulling exact language. The committee can recommend more in general sentence paragraph form. You know, we think that UAS should be allowed by law enforcement. They should generally have a warrant requirement, except there should be exceptions for search and rescue, for emergency situations, that sort of thing. And then the committee as a whole doesn't have to decide the exact details of what the draft should look at. Whichever members choose to actually introduce and really actively work on the draft once session starts can work out those kinks. If, on the other hand, the committee wants to take House Bill 312 or the draft I did or direct me to do some other draft and really work those details out, we can do that as well. But it's not required for the report.
Chair Torbett.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Another thing for consumption might be, you know, just like when you're driving a vehicle, we require that person to have a license. You know, we check his eyes and everything, because there's a safety element there. The same would should be applied with unmanned systems as well, because there is another, here again, safety issue there. So in the commercial licensing for the state, you should probably have a, you know, valid North Carolina driver's license or something that would qualify. You should be pretty much grilled on the safety aspects, on the privacy aspects, on the law of the land in North Carolina. So all that would, I think, could be applied to basically just receiving a commercial license to participate in this new and exciting economy. So I think a lot of that could be covered up in that as well.
Further questions? Members of the committee, if you will, at your leisure or as soon as possible, send your recommendations to Susan so we can have something in draft form as a report or a bill, whichever you, and also put your preference in the email. And we will have, we will pull together a document and have it at the next stated meeting.
And
we will vote on it at that time.
The draft report will actually go out at least seven days prior to the next meeting per LRC rules, and then at the final meeting you can amend that report, but that gives you a week to review what we consolidated and ditch, rewrite, whatever. So when just be aware, when you receive the draft report, it's not written in stone, but you will receive it at least a week before the meeting.
Yeah, Representative Moffitt.
Before you announce the next meeting day and time, with that 7-day advance notice, does it have to actually be on the LRC schedules, Mr. LRC Chair? Or can we have a little latitude with the month of April to get this right?
Pretty flexible. I think we gave it, Susan, didn't we give a date? All the committees were supposed to be April 7th or something like that.
The report has to be to the LRC by April 25th, okay. I think is the date. Or maybe it was April 17th and the meeting is the 25th. I'll have to double check that date.
25th is in there somewhere.
25th is the final report to the LRC? Okay. Bill, by the LRC calendar, our next meeting should be the 14th, but since we are a Monday afternoon and I don't think there's any other committees on Monday afternoon, leadership might give us a little bit of leeway to maybe meet a week later, but which would be the 21st, except that, you know, we have to have a report by the 25th. So
as Representative Setzer said, as soon as possible. If you have recommendations you'd like to see in the report, please send them to me so that we can get that done.
He's making sure staff has time to get everything ready.
Right.
Susan, is it also true that we can't make any changes after that last meeting? So any, you know, other than typographical error or correction. So the last meeting of the committee has to actually approve the report that's going to go to the ORC.
And as Bill said, an additional thing, once we send the draft report out 7 days ahead of time, if the LRC rules require that any changes to that report at the final meeting be made in writing. So when you receive that final report, if you see something you hate or you really want rewritten, if you can send that to staff before the last meeting so we can kind of draft up what you want changed, otherwise we'll be sitting here scribbling and the meeting will go on a lot longer than you want. But because the LRC rules do require that those changes be in writing before you vote on them. But we will get that out at least 7 days ahead of the next meeting, and the chairs, I suppose, will decide whether we'll meet on the 14th or some other day.
Check your email for that. Representative Speciale.
So are we still going to be able to make changes at the next meeting?
Yes. You can make changes at the next meeting, but they have to be in writing. So if you know before the next meeting, after you receive the draft report, that you want something changed, it will save time if you will email that to me before the next meeting so I can write it up before the meeting rather than sitting here handwriting.
Follow up.
I
guess my question is, we're going to send you all this stuff. You're going to make the changes. You're going to give us the draft. Or you're going to give us something to look at when we get the meeting. Can we still battle this out? Have things added and deleted during the meeting?
Yes, you can.
Yes.
I'm just saying it will save time if in that 7 days you have the draft and the final, between the 7 days you have the draft and the final meeting, if you know you want to make a change, that you send that to me in writing.
I understand.
Yeah.
I just want to make sure during the meeting.
Yes.
Yes.
It can be changed.
And if you all don't mind, when you send anything to Susan, if you send it to the chairs as well so we'll have some idea what's coming. And I would appreciate it, and so would Chairman Torbett. Any further questions from the committee? I would like to thank the committee members and the audience and the staff for your endurance through this very difficult and tedious issue. It has been trying at best to get ahead of something that is way ahead of me, I know, and my understanding. I would like to tell you all that the weather situation has been dicey, as what I understand. It's icing in Winston. Everyone be careful as you leave this building. We appreciate your time and trouble, and this meeting is adjourned.
Well done.
Just stay here a second.
Well done.
Do you, Eric, if you wish, we can set up a site visit.
I turned it off. I think it's getting hot.
We can set up a site visit. It's not a meeting.